Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime analyst on A&E Network's police documentary show, Live PD. On this episode of PD Stories, I interview former NYPD Sergeant Wally Zine. Wally's going to take us through his illustrious career, which includes taking down members of the Gambino crime family while simultaneously being called upon to be a hostage negotiator, and how he and his team found a way to wiretap the old Fulton Fish Market and the wild experience of being lead detective on night watch in the city that never sleeps. Wally, you've got a ton of stories, so let's get down to it. What made you become a police officer?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up over in Brownsville, East New York, Brownsville. And it was like a symphony. Every day, every hour, I'd hear sirens going all the time. And I really enjoyed that sound in the sense that there was always something happening. And growing up, I couldn't sit still. So I'd always run around from corner to corner at my bike, and I'd follow fire trucks, police cars, ambulances. And I really, you know, I liked that. I got into the action. Then when I was in high school, I got a job at Kings County Hospital, KCH, as they call it. And it was a really, really busy emergency room. I got a job there driving an ambulance, and I was king of the road. I'm going to tell you something. They put me in this outpost in the 75 precinct in Pitkin Avenue.
I know it. I know
Pitkin
75.
In Alabama. And I was over there. We didn't stop. And, you know, I was 17 years old.
East New York.
East New York. And I had my own ambulance with lights, sirens. So I went to college. I started at Hofstra University. I took business administration, and when I got out of Hofstra, I went into the military, came out of the military, and I was working in hospital administration, and I was working in the ambulance service, which I had a little bit of a knowledge, and I worked for the director.
How old were you then?
When I got out of college, I was about 22. As I progressed in that job, it got boring and boring. I had to stay indoors more and more and more. And one of the interesting things was when I was a kid, I took the police test in a neighborhood that when they had the NYPD walk into the nearest high school and take the test. So I took the test, and what happened was is there was a layoff because of a budgetary crisis under the mayor at the time. It was like a seven-year type of layoff of hiring, a hiring freeze. So then when I was in my hospital administrative job and, you know, running an emergency room, they called me if I wanted to come back and go into the police academy. And I said, you know, where do I sign? So I went into the police academy in 73, went through the police academy, did all the, you know, what you have to do, 6 months, and then got assigned to a precinct. And I was living my dream.
Where'd you go first?
I went to the 9-4 precinct, which is Greenpoint, and there they call it Greenpoint, because it's mostly Polish. But it was an interesting place because it was a dumping ground for the police department. And when I say dumping ground, don't take it the wrong way. It was out of the everyday MO of what police work was all about. I was in one of the first classes as a college graduate, and that was a place where they sent cops who had some problems, whether it was drinking problems, but it was a low-profile community. And they wanted us out of the police academy to mix and blend with the local police who are your training officers. What a interesting assignment on patrol there. It was very different what you learned in the police academy versus what you learned in the street. But it was an interesting place, and it was a real groundbreaker for me. But while I was there, I got laid off from the New York City Police Department because, again, budgetary crisis, and I had to find a job. And NYP at the time was offering jobs to be a bus driver for the MTA or become a correction officer over at Rikers. And I didn't want anything. So I saw a job offering in Rockland County for the Rockland County District Attorney's Office, and that job was working their narcotics task force. You know, I just started police work. So I worked in a task force with the state police in Rockland County, and I learned a lot in narcotics and things of that nature.
You went undercover?
I went deep, deep undercover there with the task. There was six of us. There was state police, myself, one other NYPD fellow who got laid off, Orange County, Spring Valley, and a couple of other areas of Rockland County where they had their own police departments. And we'd go, they'd say, pick a place, and we'd do self-generating cases. Like we'd go down Route 304 in Rockland County, and we'd people we'd pick up for hitchhiking. And they talk to us, and we make conversation and develop a rapport. And next thing we know, they're telling us where we can get some good
LSD, weed. This is the 70s.
Back in the, yes.
Yeah, so yeah, it's the drug craze 70s.
It was drug crazy.
Yeah.
But then it expanded. I'm telling you, they were telling us there was this hot truck on one of the routes in Rockland County that was selling tie sticks and hash. And if you really wanted some good stuff, you have to know the code. So we would go there every day and buy hot dogs and got to know the guy. And eventually, after a couple of months, we learned the code was I want some sauerkraut and mustard or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And he'd give you tie sticks or marijuana on top of your hot dog. Mm-hmm. And we would be buying from him. We were buying stuff left and right all over Rockland County. But it was a job that I enjoyed in the sense of his learning and I was being active again. Then and I think the reason why I lost the job, they said the funds ran out, was because we locked up the town supervisor's nephew for selling me drugs.
I can see how that'd be a problem, maybe.
Yeah. So then I came back to New York and I got a job in the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office as an investigative person and giving out subpoenas and doing the protection for the district attorney. And then finally, I got called back to NYPD. And when I got called back to NYPD, I went to the 6th Precinct, which was Greenwich Village. Wow, what a home. It was unbelievable going into a precinct, which it was nightlife. Mm-hmm. It was daylight. It just didn't end. It was so eclectic.
And this is about what year?
This was 77.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there was a lot of rules and procedures you had to follow when I was in the 6th Precinct. For an example, you couldn't live in the precinct where you work because of corruption. You go into a store and when you're off duty and you go into the store when you're on duty. The merchant gets to know you and he gives you breaks. And that goes from becoming a grass eater to a meat eater. So it changes. While I was in the 6th Precinct, and it was all my life, I always wanted to be a detective. I guess every cop has that dream. And in the New York City Police Department, you can take different investigative career paths. One is you can be in patrol, you can be in special operations, or you can become an investigator. I took the investigative route. And I was hoping someday to go into one of the investigative units. And they had a program in the police department. I'm sure it's still there today. They had an assignment for us. They took 20 of us and put us in Washington Square Park. Mm-hmm. And while in Washington Square Park, we would, in uniform, we patrol. And if you see anything, crimes committed, we'd have to take an enforcement. And while I was there, there was a guy selling drugs. And it turned out that we saw him selling drugs and we made the buy and bust. And we landed up arresting him, and I with the arresting officer. And while he was in the precinct with me, he said, listen, you know, let this go away and I'll take care of you. So we have what we call the integrity review board. Now, if you make an integrity collar like that, you can have a choice to go to one of the investigative units. But the process is you have to wire up with internal affairs. They have to come down. And so I landed up telling my sergeant. My sergeant called Internal Affairs. Internal Affairs came down. They wired me up, and he offered me a couple hundred bucks to let the thing go away. So they charged him with bribery.
Were you scared? I mean, did you have any apprehension about doing it?
No.
No?
Not that part. No, not at all. Because we worked as a group, and, you know, the name of the game in law enforcement, as you know, is team. Work as a team. And, you know, you spend more time with your partner than you do with your family.
Sure.
So that worked out well. I was able to get it written up by my superiors and ended up going through the Integrity Review Board. And the Integrity Review Board said, where do you want to go? And I said, I want to go to OCCB. That's the Organized Crime Control Bureau. And they have many different divisions within the bureau. And I went into narcotics. And then my commanding officer of that 6th precinct got transferred to that area. And he picked me up. And he brought me into a unit called Field Control, which was the internal affairs of OCCB. And that was a whole different – that was a whole different experience. But, of course, when you went into that internal affairs unit, you had to go to their academy. And I think it was about a month, you go there and learn how to steal and get caught. And it was very interesting because I had a totally different outlook about internal affairs – And I realized that it's a unit that it's a must in every law enforcement area. So while I was there, I had some very interesting cases. And
tell me about one of your cases.
There was a police officer who was selling pills. And he was a traffic cop in Manhattan. And he hung out. We had intelligence that he hung out in a parking lot area when he was off duty over on the east side. They'd have me go down there and just hang out by the parking lot. And I had an Irish Setter. Eric was his name, a dog. You know, and you got to be creative, and you got to use your own props. Mm-hmm. So I started to get down there, and I take Eric. And Eric was a very friendly dog, and I would, you know, play ball with him. And I got there, and I made friends with one person who introduced me to another person, and was there for a couple of months. And eventually I met the cop. And the cop who worked in the traffic division, you know, what do you do? And I told him I was a taxi driver because we, you know, we have a lot of undercover taxi cars. Mm-hmm. And we befriended each other, and eventually I made one buy, two buy, three buys. But the interesting part was that the traffic cops knew the undercover numbers on the taxi cabs that the police department had. The letter N at that time was the code, like 7N4620. So I went to a regular cab company and would borrow a cab when I would see him in the daytime. Eventually, he got arrested for selling pills to me. But the biggest problem we had was that my commanding officer, who there was no left or right, you know, the straightest guy by the rules, wanted to give me a command discipline because I used a non-department vehicle. And he said, if we would have had an accident, the city would have sued the police department.
Really?
Taken this taxi cab. Anyway, and eventually I got transferred, got my gold shield for a number of cases that we did.
And explain the significance of the gold shield.
The gold shield is becoming a detective. And when you get a gold shield, there are three levels of promotion. There's a third grade is when you get the gold shield, second grade, which is another position equal to sergeant's pay, and first grade is equal to lieutenant's pay. So it's a big pay hikes. But you have to do stuff over and above the normal investigative work. And there are about 8,000 detectives in NYPD today, and there are maybe a couple of hundred first-grade detectives. But, you know, you serve at the pleasure of the police commissioner. You don't take a test to become a detective. Now, if you screw up, you go back to patrol. No meal, patrol.
That's it.
That's it.
As an NYPD officer, you've seen so many things, right? What's the most bizarre case that you worked on?
A lot of them. Pick an assignment.
How about the Rainbow Yogurt case?
Rainbow Yogurt. Ah, interesting. Well, when I got transferred from OCCB, they transferred me to the Brooklyn District Attorney's Racket Squad. And I went in there as, again, being an undercover detective investigator. And while I was there, they had a complaint that came in that organized crime was running these shops along Bath Avenue where they were paying off consumer affair investigators to let them have 5-6 machines when you're only allowed 2 under the city code. So we set up a place called Rainbow Yogurt. Now, Rainbow Yogurt was a storefront over on Bath Avenue and 17th Street, right in the heart of the five families' organized crime. I was sent out as in an undercover capacity to find a location in that area. My name at that time was Michael Simon. That was my undercover name, Michael Simon. And I landed up finding a place for rent, but had to go to this real estate company over on Bath Avenue, which was ran by organized crime. When I got there, the guy asked me, what are you going to put there? I said, we want to put a yogurt store there, sell yogurts, have a couple of, you know, games in there, and just, you know, open up like a variety store. He said, that's just the place for you. And during the course of conversation, he gave me a lease, and I went back the next day with a signed lease, and he said to me, Sal, the owner of the real estate place, he said, listen, you know, you're in a very interesting area, so you want to open up these games, huh? I said, yeah, we want to put games in there. He said, well, you know what? You're going to get a partner. His name is Carmine. Carmine Lamondosi is his name. So I said, okay, who's Carmine? I don't know who Carmine Lamondosi is. Carmine Lamondosi was Carmine the doctor, the captain of the Gambino family.
Wow.
And Sal said to me, he says, you know, you need an umbrella. I'm saying to myself, an umbrella? Carmine, an umbrella? I don't even know. You know, I'm new at this job. I said, what do you mean an umbrella? He says, you know, in case you have lightning hits, you need Carmine. So I go back to the DA's office, and I'm wired up, of course. Everything I did was wired. And they play the tape back, and the intelligence officers that are there and the bosses say, you're going to meet Carmine Lamondosi, the doctor? So that was like the biggest thing. We're getting into a captain without going through soldiers to get to the next level.
This is the Gambino family.
And this is the
about.
John Gotti Gambino family, yeah. Number one on the chart. So we get in there, and I said, why do they call him the doctor? Because I really got scared. I figured, you know, if the mob maybe chops up bodies or something like that. Mm-hmm. But Carmine handled paper in Wall Street. He would doctor up different types of stocks, bonds, and things of that nature.
Really smart guy. Yeah.
Very smart guy. So I went back. We opened up. It was myself. My partner was Danny Pantano. Rest in peace, Danny. And there were two other detectives from the intelligence division that were our backups. So as time went on, Carmine came down to the place and we met, and I introduced him to all my, you know, the guys that worked there. And Carmine said, anyone comes into this place with you, you're going to have to tell them you want to see Carmine. Don't answer any questions. Michael, this is my place. And every Wednesday, you come to the Gratadora restaurant in Sheepshead Bay and you bring me the money. Mm. So now, you know, I'm in with Carmine. I have to pay the vig to him. Mm. And Carmine, as time went on, I'd meet him over the Gratadora. The first time I went there, these women come up to me, and I had just broken my ankle. And even though I didn't go on sick report, I had a cast on my ankle. And when I got there, these women would come up and say, you want to see Carmine? And they would like hug me to see if I was wearing a wire. Mm. And my wire was in the cast on my foot. So when I got there, Carmine would give me my vig. I'd give him whatever money it was. And Carmine said to me one day, he said, you know, Michael, we got to make more money. And we're going to put a little casino in the back room. Mm. And it's escalating. It's getting
better. This is Goodfellas.
Better. It's
this
getting
is Goodfellas,
better
right?
And better and better. So the next things that happened was I go back to the DA's office, and we now wire up the back room. So I'm there, and the next thing that happens, he sends in three slot machines for the back and a big card table. So he's going to run card games and slot machines back there. And what's so interesting is that when we ran the numbers on the slot machines, it turned out those slot machines were scheduled to be sent to Bally. But they fell off the back of the truck and
imagine
went
that
to Rainbow Yogurt. So as we were progressed again, Carmine says to me, Michael, you got to start taking action. And I don't know how to do numbers. You know, I guess I was successful because I didn't know anything and I wasn't pulling any punches with him. I started to take numbers, and also he wanted me to take horse betting.
Mm. And you had to learn about all this.
Yeah, but you know what? We'd meet him at another location. His bookmaking place was over by the Manhattan Bridge. And there was a little social club there, so we'd go over there. So as things progressed, as I said, things got better and better and better. We were able to fence jewelry to him that was from the police department's stuff that was gotten. And it just went really, really well. And he introduced us to Friday night's after-hour clubs in Brooklyn. And he introduced us to a place called Pastels. And we used to meet there at like 12 o'clock at night.
Pastels Champagne Lounge.
Champagne Lounge, man. It was really something. It was the back room was just for the mob. Just for the mob kinder, as we'd say, their children. It was really funny because then after that, they tell us where to go. So we learned all these after-hour clubs to put down for a raid when we were going to close the case. So as it went on, one of my partners, Detective Billy Peist, but things really were strange because we'd always see Billy come to the place, and when he was off duty, he worked very hard on duty. It turned out that his wife was John Gotti's niece.
Oh.
And it turned out, we found out later on when we went to arrest Carmine and his crew, Carmine and his crew came up to us and said, Michael, we know you're a cop. We're just trying to help you get your business off the ground. We weren't trying to do anything illegal.
And really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, but we had to close the case down. We made about 6-7 arrests on that, including Carmine. You know, we didn't know at that time, no one knew that Billy Pice was, you know, working both sides, was a turnkey. Billy eventually, later on, got arrested. He came up on a wire that was going on with other parts of the investigation.
Did Billy go to prison?
Yes, he might still be in prison.
Wow.
That was very dangerous because we could have gotten killed.
Tell me about working night watch at NYPD. What's it like?
Night watch. That was probably one of my best assignments I've ever had. When I made sergeant, I left the Brooklyn DA's office and started to work in squads. I went to the 13th squad as the second whip there. Second whip means there's a lieutenant and then a sergeant run the squad. Then I went to Midtown North. And I'll tell you what bothered me about the squads. Great, great job. You know, you're a detective now. You're a boss. You're out there wearing your suit and everything. It was really great. But the problem I had in the squads, you'd work 8-4, 4-1. And the next thing that happened, you'd be loaded with paper to sign. 95% of your time is going over cases. It was mostly paper. If you got out on a homicide or something, or a major case, something newsworthy, that's when you went out. The other than that, you were just doing paper and doing case management. So they had an opening up for night watch. Now, night watch was a midnight to 8 assignment. Now, there are 26 precincts in Manhattan, and they are covered with about 600-plus detectives from 8 to 4 and 4 to 1. Night watch at the time, when I got there, I had 18 detectives to cover all of Manhattan. And what we would do, night watch was basically you'd go out there on midnight to 8 on any homicides. It was reactive. It was never proactive. And I would ride around because I had the whole borough, and detectives would stay in the office waiting for a call. And I realized that it has to change somehow, because all the stuff that hits the fan was on midnight to 8. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different breed of people, characters that come out at night.
I worked night shift when I was SPO in D.C. I know, it's a whole nother thing at night.
It's unbelievable. And what I did is I set up like a little mini chief of detectives. So I went to the chief, and the chief, after about 6 months there, the chief said, you know, Wally, let's try it. He said you can pick, you know, a group of detectives that you want, that want to come. And I said, it has to only be that want to come. And it would be people that, say, were going to school in the daytime, or they had to take care of the kids during the daytime. So what I did is I took one detective from crime scene. I took one detective from homicide. I took one detective from robbery, one detective from gangs, one detective from internal affairs. And we were able, I took from all the different divisions within the detective bureau, and we had our own little mini chief of detectives. We were averaging 3-4 homicides a week. So, and we would have to put a crime scene detective there. And having one crime scene detective, he knew what to do, because we'd get other calls that would come, rape, shootings. And it worked out perfectly. You couldn't make up the types of situations that came on in Night Watch. I remember one night working, it was about 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I get a call from the 2-4 precinct desk officer. And he says to me, hey, I got this kid from Columbia University. He was riding around on his bicycle and smoking a joint. One of the uniform guys locked him up for smoking a joint. And I said, that really doesn't fall under our purview, but what else? He said, well, you know, he knows some guy who's chopping up a body right now.
He knows somebody who's chopping up a body right now.
Right now, right.
Okay, go on.
The desk officer says, probably bullshit. I said, well, listen, you're giving me this thing. I got to look into it. So my driver and I went down to the 2-4 precinct, and there's this kid, and we see the kid, and the kid says, listen, I just got into Columbia. I'm a freshman. I don't want to lose this and everything, I want to help you guys. She says, I know a guy that's chopping up a body. He did it before. And I said, continue. He says to me, there's this guy that loves water views who's over at the housing development, that here's the way it works. What he does is he finds someone living in the housing development. If they're living there alone, the way the payment is done, the welfare department and the housing department pay each other through computer. And if they have no next of kin and you die, they still keep paying until something comes up. So
and the apartment becomes unoccupied.
Right. I had them send a uniform car over to that apartment building. Sure enough, we get a call on the radio, 1085, 1085, forthwith. That means send more officers there. There's a guy here chopping up a body. So we get there. Sure enough, this guy, like a butcher, was chopping up a body.
Good
and
Lord.
Big, big guy. In fact, you couldn't even put one handcuff on.
You had to do double handcuffs?
Double handcuff this guy. And I saw them bringing him out, and I said, take him over to the 3-4, and we'll debrief him. What he did is he took parts of the body, and he spread it out over the houses. We were able to find all the parts of the body except the head. Now, this is what gets interesting. The media picked up on this, of course. This is a major story.
Oh, yeah.
And the chief of detectives wanted a 12 o'clock press conference. So he comes up to the crime scene and he says, find the head. We need that we have a complete body for the medical examiner. And we looked in the freezer and there was this pot with look like parts. It was a chopped up chicken. And the chief detective said, is this the head? I said, we can't use this as a head because it would land up the medical exam. We'll find out it was a chicken. So my detectives went under the sink. I don't know if you ever touched a plastic bag and rubbed it with your hair in it. He found the head. What happened, he couldn't throw the head out the window because of the children bars. There was this torso in the bathtub. I didn't eat roast beef for about a month. But Night Watch was such an interesting place. Some interesting story. I remember one day getting a call on Halloween night. And I'll never forget this one. You know, there's always like three or four stories you just never forget. Mm-hmm. Halloween night, there's a gang shooting in this house, and the kid gets shot through the head, and the bullet went through his head and right through the floor underneath. So, of course, we set up a crime scene. We start the investigation. And remember, it's Halloween night. We went downstairs to the apartment right under his, and it was decorated with all these Halloween different artifacts. They had a spider web, which was on the door, and all the blood was dripping down through the bullet hole that went through his head.
Onto the spider web.
Onto the spider web. And I'll never forget that.
Wow.
It was so surreal. It was unreal.
Let's talk about the Fulton Fish Market corruption case.
Well, after Night Watch, I went to the Department of Investigation. Department of Investigation handles 13 mayoral agencies. And what they do is they handle anyone that the mayor wants to appoint. We do the background investigations. Any corruption in any city agency except the police department, and any company, no matter what it is, doing business with the 13 mayoral agencies. So we had someone made a complaint that the Fulton Fish Market was dirty, organized crime. And it didn't come to us yet. So after their investigation, it went to the Manhattan District Attorney's office. The Manhattan District Attorney set up a commission that just oversaw the Fulton Fish Market. Now, this is in Manhattan, not the one presently in the Bronx. So while this was going on, they wanted to form a task force. So they had myself and five detectives, FBI supervisor and five detectives, and the Manhattan District Attorney's office with detectives. And what we did is we set up an undercover operation. Started off, we called it Stingray Express. Stingray Express was a company that we would go out every morning, except on Saturday and Sunday, to Montauk. And we would buy fish off the boats. And then we'd bring it back to the Fulton Fish Market. And we would try to violate every law you can think of that the mob created down there. We knew that they had to pay for parking. You had to pay for unloading your truck, 35 cents a pound at the time.
You had to pay the mob.
Mob, yeah. They had each family had their own little group there. They had corners. Gambinos, the Bananos, the Lucchesis. You know, they whacked it up between all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So while we were down there, and it took a long time. It didn't happen overnight. It took like maybe 6, 7, 8 months to get recognized. And we come there every day. And they started off with unloading the fish. And when we were unloading the fish, at first we didn't want to pay to have it unloaded. And eventually they told us, you don't pay, you're going to have problems. And we didn't pay and we didn't park. And we did this purposely because we had an outpost across the street in the Con Ed building where we were filming everything. We wanted problems in the worst way. So while we were there, they actually, and we had it on film, they would actually take a forklift truck, and they'd actually take the vans that we had and put it over in the East River on low tide.
They would literally lift it up with a forklift and drop it in the river?
Drop it in the river. And that just to show us. We got so entrenched with them. We found out one day one of the guys came over to us and says, you know, you're working this hours. You need to get a gun apiece. You know, you're going out to Montauk. You know, no one's going to with you. And we said, sure, how do we get a gun? He said, over at the catering truck. Every night there was one catering truck that would come there like 3 o'clock in the morning. Uh-huh. And you'd have to buy coffee and donuts from him. And so he needed a password to get a piece. You have any magnums or muffins? Magnums or muffins? We landed up buying about 25 guns, and it was really taking off. Now, this was starting the second year down there. One of the other interesting things that happened was that, all the shellfish that would come into the market every day had to be inspected. And the inspectors would come down, and they would take samples randomly from the different sales fish places. And it would take like 2-3 days to get the results back if they were toxic or not. And already that day when they took them, all those shellfish were being sold. Mm-hmm. So that didn't work. The other thing, we got into narcotics. We made contacts with them, but we had to film the operation. So to get into the locations that we wanted to buy the drugs from, we had to get a court order to wire the place up. And, you know, at that hour, 3-4 in the morning, you couldn't really get anything, you know, get in there because it would be so busy. So what we did, we had some very smart, attractive female detectives that worked in this undercover operation. So we decided we're going to do a film shoot right in the middle of the Fulton Fish Market, a magazine shoot. And we had everything. We borrowed the cameras with no film in it. And we had like 3 of our models, detectives. We started the shoot and we'd have the girls marching around. And they started the shoot and they all stopped their high-lows and they'd start coming over to watch this. And they'd all clapping and this and that, being, you know, street people. We were able to get in there in less than a half hour, bug the place and wire the whole place up with cameras and audio so we could film the drug deals.
What a brilliant distraction.
The nice part why it worked so well is that we worked as a team. And that was basically, you know, Fulton Fish Market.
Wally, how'd you get into hostage negotiation?
Hostage negotiation, I think, was my best assignment that I had in the police department. And the reason why I consider it the best assignment is because, one, you learn a lot. It's a totally different learning process. Secondly, you get a chance to use all your skills that you would train with and all your skills that you grew up with. And in addition to that, any hostage incident in New York City, the highest ranking person that oversees, the chief that comes to that scene, lets you negotiate. And the reason for that is because that chief has to answer to the community the next day. Mm-hmm. So in 1982, while I was in the district attorney's office as an undercover, they had openings for hostage negotiators. So I applied. And process is very different today, but it was a long process. You have to go through psychological testing. You have to go through physicals. You have to go through personal interviews. And but when I got out of the Brooklyn DA's office, I started to be overt in the sense of being a sergeant in detective squads, a detective sergeant. So then I started getting calls to hostage incidents. And the first part, when you first become a hostage negotiator, you did a lot of time going to the scenes and watching, observing. About our hostage team is very unique because we started it in 1972 under the direction of Frank Bultz and a fellow named Harvey Schlossberg. Interesting. Harvey Schlossberg was a traffic cop on Wall Street directing traffic, but he had a PhD in psychology. So he got picked up. And how did that start? Because of what took place in the Munich Olympics when they assassinated the Israeli athletes. And also, we had an incident that happened in Brooklyn at John and Al's sporting goods store where they had many hostages and two cops were killed. And we learned that the important thing is to negotiate. And through that, the hostage team is where it is today. To become a hostage negotiator today, you have to have at least 12 years on a job. You must be a detective. You must have good recommendations, not just from your supervisor, from all the way up to the chiefs. And then you have to go to school for 2 weeks. And you do a lot of role playing. You do psychological. You learn about many of the different types of hostages. Today, we're doing about 380 calls a year, which is a lot.
That's not more than one a day.
There are only four types of hostage takers in the world.
And what are they?
First one is a professional criminal. Professional criminal is the person that walks into a bank or a supermarket and someone hits the silent alarm and then you negotiate. He's basically the easiest one because he wants to get out. He wants something to do. The second one is the prison inmate who may want better food, conjugal visits or whatever, but that one you have to go fast because if you don't go fast, other inmates start getting together and they start to form a crowd and an uprising could occur. The other two is a terrorist who's a martyr. If he lands up getting neutralized.
And has a political goal.
He has a goal. And the fourth one, which is the hardest and the longest, is usually the EDP, an emotionally disturbed person. Now, the EDP could be, most of them are domestic, boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife. She has an order of protection or he has an order of protection, goes in there, violates that. Next thing you know, he's holding them hostage. No one wants to listen to me. You got the jumper off the bridge who has a statement to make, and that's why it takes so long.
What was the most difficult hostage negotiation you ever had to deal with?
Well, first of all, when you enter a hostage situation, it's like going into the middle of a movie. You don't know the beginning, you don't know the end. The most important thing is to be able to understand the protocols. For an example, the first 10 to 30 minutes of any hostage incident is the most dangerous, where you either get hurt or you get killed. And the reasoning for that is because the hostage taker is looking for a place that he or she can be comfortable with. The people that are taken hostage are, you know, going through a fight or flight in the sense that they're trying to find a location. The first 10 to 30 minutes is called panic reaction. And panic reaction also is when the police are getting there. They're looking for cover and containment. They're looking for the proper location where they can be safe. So it becomes very, very tough. So when you have that happen and after things settle down, what we try to do, we work in a three-person team. We have a negotiator, we have a coach, and we have a floater. All interchangeable in case the person who you're talking to doesn't like you, you want to be able to interchange. Or if it keeps going and going and going, you want to have a time to, you know, take a break. The most touching hostage incident to me was I had an incident in Queens where a fella just got out of Rikers Island. Jared was his name. And he was holding a group of people hostage, and a newborn baby was just maybe 2-3 months old. He wanted to see his girlfriend, and she was out. And he was really upset that he couldn't see him. And turned out that he shot the girlfriend's mother. She died. And shot two other people in that also didn't die, but were very seriously injured. This was a private house over in Queens in the 113th precinct. So when I got there, and I can see in the building when I pulled up there, there was the blinds were going up and down a little bit. And I had a bullhorn, and we already knew his name was Jared. And I said, Jared, I'm Wally. I want to talk to you. And I said, it's real important that we don't just talk through the bullhorn. Let's talk on a phone, and let's try to make this thing come to an ending. So Jared was holding his newborn daughter and wanted to speak to his girlfriend, Diane. That's one thing we don't do. We try not to put second intermediaries in there. We don't let psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers come in to talk because they take valuable time away from us. And what they do is if they come in, they're doing everything proper, but they start talking about their your relationship with your mother and father when you were born. We're not that, we're a Band-Aid effect. We want to get in, get out, and save everybody.
But in this case, he wanted to talk to her.
Yes.
And you didn't want him to actually talk to her.
Now, we learned from past experience, if you have a person that's upset with a member, a girlfriend, or a boyfriend, you don't let them talk. Also, we never let a religious person talk, a priest, a rabbi, because that's what we call absolution. They'll usually say, you see, Father, you see what I did? I'm asking you to ask God to forgive me. Boom. Then they shoot themselves. Mm. And it's the same thing that could have happened with him. He could have said, Diane on the phone, listen, you caused me to get this and that. Look what happened. Boom. So we never do that. We never let that happen. So during the course of, it was like a 7-hour negotiation, and he said he's going to send the woman out with the child. And one thing in our hostage negotiating program is that no matter who comes out of the apartment, they're always looked upon as the hostage taker or house, because we don't know. We don't know if they're, you know, trying to escape. So we have a protocol that to bring him out, and this man came out instead of a woman. He came out with the baby. After 7 hours, I was able to talk to him, and I spoke to him about myself having 3 children and how important it is, what a great father you are. In the background, you can hear the baby crying. And finally, the child and the man came out. And that was a very rewarding part for me, because that child saw the next day. And recently, I spoke to Cheyenne, who was the baby. And
who's grown now?
She's 16. 16 years ago this happened. And she called to, well, she didn't call. I called her because some TV station in England wants to do a rerun of this. And her and her mother got on the phone to thank me, and they were in tears.
Wow. Wally, did you ever have to do a hostage negotiation while you were working undercover?
I had one incident like that, and it was very unusual. Keep in mind, NYPD has 125 hostage negotiators. And the way the team works is that when you're doing your regular assignment, when a hostage incident takes place, you have to then drop what you're doing and go to the hostage incident. So I was working in the Fulton Fish Market at the time, and it was over in the Department Investigation Squad. And there was an incident that took place over in the East Village. There was a guy by the name of Mordechai Levy. He was the president of the JDO, not the
Jewish
JDL.
Defense Organization?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He landed up barricading himself in an apartment, and the word was that he had explosives in the apartment. And how this came about was that 2 marshals came to see him about something of that he was violating, whether it was his car or something of that nature, that dealt with the Marshals Department. He thought they were Mossad, the Israeli intelligence coming to whack him.
Mm.
So he barricaded himself, and the hostage team responded there. And they started a negotiation, and Mordechai said, I only want to talk to a Jew. Being Jewish, I was one of the few Jews in the hostage negotiation team. And I spoke a little Yiddish.
Uh-huh.
So I got called, and, you know, I was working undercover. So I got there, and surreptitiously I got there, and we had a hostage van. Our command post is a hostage van. It's darkened, and we have all the communication equipment in
there. Is it like in the movies?
Like in the movies, but a little more sophisticated. No, I should say the other way around. We had what we needed. So Mordechai said, I only want to talk to a Jewish person, Jewish negotiator. Mm-hmm. So they introduced me. We're going to talk to Wally. And so I got on the phone. I said, Shalom, Mordechai. And Mordechai says, that's the all you know? What's your Jewish name? So I said, Velvel. That is my Jewish name, Velvel. So I said, Shalom, Velvel. And he says, all right, let's talk a little bit. So we start talking, and I'm saying to myself, wow, my first terrorist. This is going to be like weeks. So he says to me, Velvel, why don't you come up to the apartment and let's have some tea? And I said to him, you know, I born at night, but not last night. So I'm not, you know, I'm staying right here. Mm-hmm. So to make a long story short, we started talking and he said what he wanted. And he said, I want you to talk to my attorney. And I said, make it even better. I'll have my attorney, meaning your attorney, talk to the assistant district attorney who was there. And everything worked out in less than an hour. So leaving, you know, it was a big media thing. Mm-hmm. I had to get out of there.
Because you're still undercover.
Because I'm still undercover. So we had a ballistic blanket, which is about 8 feet by 4 feet, mm-hmm. and emergency service carries it in case of an explosive. This way it protects you. Mm-hmm. So they had the blanket, and I walked out with the, you know, behind the blanket to my car. But it turned out the New York Post was down the block, and they were clicking away. They saw me. So they were going to run it, and it turned out my best friend, Jerry Nachman, was the editor of the Post. So I was able to get Jerry on the phone, and my boss got on the phone with him, and they didn't show the pictures. So I was cool. I didn't get burnt.
And Wally, a lot of these situations are similar to an active shooter, which we unfortunately see more and more all over the country. What are some tips you can give our listening audience about how to stay safe in an active shooter situation?
Great question, Tom. Always remember, you're going to be a hostage. You're going to be in there for a very long time. There are a few protocols that are very important. First, remember that the first 10 to 30 minutes is the worst time to be there. We call that panic reaction. Find a place, get in a relaxed position, and don't try to be a hero. Never be a hero in a hostage incident. Remember to remain calm. Another thing that's so important, if you have any type of medical condition, whether you're on drugs for diabetes, heart conditions, make sure you tell the hostage taker that you're on medications, because a hostage taker does not want a sick hostage. They'll be the first to let go. Hmm. The other thing is only speak when you're spoken to, because you don't want to be the person that's going to agitate the hostage taker. Remember, if you're going to speak to the police, now the hostage taker may put you on the phone to talk to the police. Always remember with yes and no answers. Don't get into a whole details. The other thing, which is always important, is remember the police at some point are going to make a dynamic entry if the hostage taker does not come out. When they do dynamic entries, you should hit the ground, stay low, because they'll go for the largest mass from the neck down to the torso. The torso is the largest mass. So stay low. You're always going to be spoken to by the police. You're always going to be debriefed and follow the commands. When you're coming out, they're probably going to tell you to keep your hands up, maybe walk out backwards. And the reason for that is we don't know who the hostage taker is at that point. So everyone's subject.
You know, when we were growing up, we're original baby boomers.
And right.
When we were coming up in the 60s and 70s, we didn't have people shooting up schools. It just wasn't happening. And then Columbine happened in, I guess, 92. And from there on, we've seen this phenomenon. What do you think is different now in these last couple of decades that makes teenagers want to kill everybody at their school?
Well, I think, you know, you have to go back to bullying.
But they were always bullies. I got bullied in Philly as a kid. I mean,
here's the catch. The catch is social media. We are in a time period today where everyone is a war correspondent. They're out there taking pictures. They're out there real time getting their messages out. You know what's so interesting about the school shootings that I've noticed? It's not coming from the gangs.
No.
It's coming from middle class people. Mm-hmm. We have to take a better look at this. And we're not. You know, the interesting part is that, like the school shootings, the FBI, the police departments, when they get a call of a suspicious person, it doesn't run on the hit parade as a number one call to respond to. You know, it falls in the queuing technique. So we got to take a better look at this. We got to set up a better system. And that is city, state, federal, working with educators, working with the media, working with informants, working together, working with the community is so important. Neighborhood policing is the key today.
Have you ever fired your weapon on a suspect in the line of duty?
Yes, off duty.
Off duty?
It was one of the Manhattan district attorney, assistant district attorney, was having a Christmas party. And as I was leaving the party, there was a man trying to break into my car. And we're not allowed to shoot somebody for breaking into your car unless deadly physical force is presented to you or another person. Mm-hmm. So I stopped him and I said, "Police." And he took off. He started running. There was my car. The windows were busted. And I started, you know, to chase, you know, to find him and make an off-duty arrest. And I went down, was following the guy, and he got into Grand Central Station. I asked a uniform cop who was there, told him what happened. So he pulls the guy up and throws him against the wall. And as he's tossing him, frisking him, the guy pulls out a tire iron and hits the cop over the head. And the cop goes unconscious. I turn around, and he comes at me with the tire iron, and I shot him. Like a gazelle, a deer.
He took off running.
This guy took off. I couldn't believe how fast he was. So I'm chasing a guy, and the guy runs down right on the corner from Grand Central is the regular MTA IRT subway, and he runs onto the track, and I look, and I don't know the system with the tracks, the third rail. I don't want to get electrocuted. So I was able to get more police, called in a 1013, cop needs assistance, and they never found the guy.
What?
Never found the guy.
He didn't show up at a hospital shot or anything?
They did a complete canvas, but we never found him. Then I had to go through the process.
For a shooting?
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Had to go before the grand jury, IAB, first in the shooting team. Anyway, I went through hell, but everything was found justified.
Wow, that is quite a story. And never found the guy.
Never found the guy.
That's crazy. Wally, what advice would you give to people who are thinking about going into law enforcement and becoming police officers?
First of all, I tell them it's a great experience. There's requirements now that have escalated. It used to be you needed a high school graduate. Now you have to have a minimum of 63 credits, an associate's degree, and you go to the academy. It's 6 months. But the police department now has changed its whole concept. You know, there's an old saying that dinosaurs would be here today if they were able to deal with change. And the police department, NYPD, and I speak for them, they have made significant changes in the way they're teaching police officers in the academy. It's no more when you get out of the police academy, you're training officers. All right, kid, what you learned there, forget about it. This is the street. It doesn't work that way anymore. It's working with communities. Community policing is the foundation of good policing. The media has to work close with the police law enforcement. The way it's trained today, the classes in the police academy are much smaller. They're not 50 cadets in one room. The five boroughs, New York, is cornucopia. You know, it's just unbelievable how many different ethnic groups and groups we have there. And the police department now, NYPD, takes these groups out there to meet the different communities. And plus, our hiring has changed. When I came in the department, it was Italian and Irish. And it's changed now. It's more and more people from all over the world. And we're so fortunate to have that because we're able to communicate better on certain situations. And technology has changed. Cops now have, all cops have iPhones where they can actually do real-time investigative work, even the patrol officers. So it's changed, and it's a job that's very rewarding. You know, again, if you're going in there for money, think again. But if you're going in there to help people, join NYPD or any other law enforcement agency.
If you could do it all over again, would you still be a police officer?
Absolutely. What's wrong with you?
You know, I knew the answer to that.
Two things that I must say about the police department and any law enforcement. You know, crime doesn't discriminate. So if you're working in a small, medium, large, city, state, or federal, I can only say that NYPD was a ringside seat to the greatest show on earth, and it didn't cost me a dime. Yeah. And on top of that, it gave me a PhD from the street.
Absolutely. Wow, this has been an amazing conversation, Wally Zines. I mean, what a career. And God bless you, man.
God bless you.
Thank you for coming on PD Stories. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us for PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr. Don't forget to watch me every Friday and Saturday night on Live PD on A&E at 9 o'clock.
TV Stories is an A&E production produced in association with Audio Boom. TV Stories is executive produced and created by Sue Funk for A&E Networks.